Thank you, Sally, and members of the Mount Vernon, Skagit, and Blaine Unitarian Universalist Fellowships, churches. I couldn't help but think of the first time I had the opportunity to speak at a Unitarian Universalist Fellowship in Mount Vernon, and it was either in 1990 or 1991, so that's a long time ago. Some of you may know that I grew up in the Unitarian Universalist Church in New York City. It was John Haynes Holmes Church, later to become Donald Harrington's church. And so as I watched those images that you showed early on of the Black Southern freedom struggle, I couldn't help but think of how many times and how many Sundays I was there at church as a young person, because in the days long before the internet, the Unitarian Universalist Church of New York was where we got our news about what was really taking place in this country. Some of the young people who went down, who were older than I was, and went down south for Freedom Summer, came from the church, and each Sunday, Don would be there updating us about the latest news. So really, it's impossible for me to think about those days without thinking about my involvement growing up in community church in New York. And it's wonderful to hear how now there are seven principles, which one can talk about in describing oneself as a Unitarian Universalist. In our Sunday school class, we came up with just one. And we looked at all the things that people did in the name of various religions and in the name of various contexts of social justice. And somebody came up with the idea that we weren't Hindus, but Unitarian Universalists were undoes. And that if we were the ones who were a little different because we chose the direction that we wanted to move in our own faith, in our own spirituality, in our own commitment to social justice. And I always like that. So sometimes when people ask me, what am I? I'll say, religiously, I'm an undo. Not a Hindu, but an undo. I thought that a really great way to undoing things with you this morning would be to begin by reading from the first few pages of my recent book, which you'll see over, I guess it's my left shoulder, the right side of your screen, of Blood and Sweat, Black Lives and the Making of White Power and Wealth, which HarperCollins just released last Tuesday. I like this selection from the book because I think it describes what I was trying to accomplish in writing this book. And it also forms a really great basis for us to talk further about the issues, not only in this book, but I think the issues that are of concern today. So this is from chapter one, Anthony Negro and Isabel Negro is how they were known in the 1625 ledger of Captain William Tucker of Elizabeth City, Virginia, near Hampton today. In all likelihood, they also had African names that only the ages know now. They may have been baptized shortly after birth, and their Anglicized names conferred then by Portuguese priests who'd ventured deep into the interior of Angola, where Catholicism was well established by the 16th century. Or Portuguese priests may have performed obligatory baptisms and christenings of these two young people as they were herded into the hold of the St. John the Baptist, a Portuguese slave ship at anchor in Luanda Bay off the coast of Angola in the late Central African rainy season of 1619. Let's call them Anthony and Isabella for our narrative. Two, among the 20 and odd Negroes Sir John Rolfe recorded aboard the Dutch man of war, the White Lion, lying at anchor on August 20th, 1619, at the mouth of the James River off Point Comfort. Anthony and Isabella carried within them the germinal seeds of the first Black child born in America, though on that fateful day in August 1619, they probably did not know that, nor did they know his name. Nor could they have known that symbolically they also carried within them the germinal cells of Scipio and Crispus and Nat and Sojourner and Maggie and Frederick and Booker T and W.E.B. and Marcus and Langston and Duke and Yardbird and Train and Malcolm and Martin and Rosa and Barack and Trayvon and Eric and Breonna and George and me. And countless millions who in some measure or part were torn, like them, from Africa's soil. Anthony and Isabella stepped from the decks of the White Lion into a pinnace, bobbing in the surf off Point Comfort, Virginia, a small boat that would carry them to the white planters and merchants and colonists waiting ashore. Men who had just determined their worth in terms of salted meat and vegetables and grain and the other provisions needed by the captain of the White Lion. What they did not know then, could not know then, is that in being handed over to these men, they were about to embark on a journey of unimaginably epic proportions. A heroic journey in which during their lives, they would endure great hardships and privations, a symbolic journey that would see their work lay the foundation of the economics, politics, religion, medicine, education, industry, law enforcement, and technology of a new nation, and a hard-earned journey that would generate great power and wealth for some that sadly, Anthony and Isabella, and those like them for the most part, would never share. In their interaction with those white men ashore lay the embryonic maps of many roads, some surveyed and taken, others surveyed and deemed unworthy. American slavery, American freedom, Bacon's Rebellion, the Revolutionary War, the Constitution, the Declaration of Independence, the Bill of Rights, Nat Turner's Rebellion, the Cotton Gin, the Age of Sail, the Civil War, Reconstruction, Jim Crow, the Great Migration, railroads, mines, oil drilling, cars, racism, lynching, Red Summer, two world wars, two marches on Washington, the murders of Malcolm and Martin, the gunning down of Trayvon and Ahmaud, the killing of George Floyd, and the many other events shaped by the interaction of Black folks and white folks here in America. Anthony and Isabella did not know this then, and neither did the men ashore, like Captain William Tucker, who would acquire and settle the couple to work on his farm near present-day Hampton, Virginia. But today, we can know what came of those seeds, real and symbolic, which Anthony and Isabella carried within them. We can know of the roads taken and those that were not, and where they could not know, we must not forget. The Los Angeles Times, in a very gracious way, published an op-ed to coincide with the release of my book by HarperCollins. And that op-ed was entitled, "I Never Imagined as a Black Author that I Would Put Myself in Harm's Way." And in that op-ed, I talked about really not just myself, but the many African-American authors today who face threats simply for writing. I would say within 2 hours of the release of that op-ed, my Twitter account, my inbox, and my website started to get hate mail. And it was really funny. I wrote to some friends and said, you know, I think we're doing something right here because of the reaction we got. it's a sad commentary that I probably hit somewhat the right nerve, so to speak, because this is just a demonstration of exactly what I was writing about. One of the most frequent questions that I get in response to this book is this a book about critical race theory? And so I thought that would be a really good thing for us to address, particularly with a group of Unitarian Universalists who are very committed to social justice and important ideas in the public domain. And my answer has consistently been, it was on Good Morning America when I had the opportunity to appear there. It was and has been in all of my talks on this book since, that what those on both sides of this issue of critical race theory don't understand is the difference between a theory and historical truths. A theory is the way you look at, try to make sense of, try to understand what facts are assembled in front of you, whether it's scientific facts about a virus or whether it's historical facts about what took place in this country. Unfortunately, this whole discussion of critical race theory has confused, I'm not even sure I would say confused, most people don't even take the time to separate out or to understand the difference that theory is not fact. Theory is in a way to try to understand fact or historical truths. And so I have said to people, no, my book is not a book about critical race theory, it's a book about historical truths. And interestingly enough, not surprisingly enough, in unearthing many of those historical truths, what those truths do is to support many of the ideas of critical race theory. But I hope, in just saying this very, very briefly, and if we do have times for question later, I'm more than happy to talk more about this. I think it's important for us not to adopt the terms of those who would be against critical race theory by assuming somehow that there's the similarity between critical race theory, which is a theory, and historical truths, which we can document in other ways. Even though in the world we live in today, truth seems to be based on who's got the public's attention and maybe the loudest voice, look, there are still some facts we can go back to. So let me just give you an example of the separation or the difference or what I mean by critical race theory or theory and historical truths. So in my book, for example, I talk about Thomas Jefferson. And yes, we know that he was a slaveholder, but more importantly than keeping enslaved people, at least for me, is that Thomas Jefferson was a debtor. So was George Washington, James Madison. Many of the founding fathers were really founding debtors. They owed huge amounts of money. When Jefferson died, his estate owed some $2 million in today's terms. They had very lavish lifestyles. They supported those lavish lifestyles on credit extended to them from European merchants. And at a certain point, shortly before the American Revolutionary War, those credit had tightened in Europe, and the merchants that had extended all these gentlemen credit said, look, we want our money. Of course, they didn't have the money. So what did Jefferson do? Jefferson wrote letters basically of debt or mortgage to his creditors in England and Amsterdam, the Netherlands rather, in which he pledged by name the enslaved individuals that he owned as collateral for his debt. Now that's a historical truth. I'm not saying that. I simply went to the Library of Congress. I went to the Jefferson Foundation. And on the website for the book, I actually have a copy in Thomas Jefferson's hand of the letters that he wrote to his European creditors pledging the enslaved people on his plantation in Monticello as collateral for his debt. Human beings being pledged as collateral for debt. That's a historical fact. The other historical fact that goes along with that is that began a process in which banks throughout the South in particular, but also banks as they were bought up by Northern banks, saw this was a really great idea for them in terms of business. And so every major name in banking today has in its history this aspect of owning enslaved people as collateral for the debt. So in other words, if you're a Southern planter and you were also a slave owner and you wanted more money to buy more land and more people that you can enslave, you would then go to a bank and say, look, I'm going to pledge to you these individuals that I own. And if I default on this loan, guess who gets to take the collateral that I pledged? And that's why there are so many banks in the South who ended up being slave owners, or not in a small degree. We're talking about thousands of enslaved individuals that predecessors to Citibank and predecessors to J.P. Morgan and Chase and Wells Fargo and Truist and all of the names that we know in banking today had. Now, those are historical facts. We can trace them back. We can find the documents. I display them in my book. I have them on the website, talk about them in the book. The theory is, wow, that is evidence of a racism that is deeply ingrained in the banking system. Well, personally, I happen to agree with that. But what's important and what I really tried to do in the book is not write about the theory as much as I wanted to display and talk about the historical truths. And that's why I say, no, this is not a book about critical race theory. More importantly, it's a book about historical truths. And I tried to take epochs in time and tell these historical truths, not just as dry facts with statistics and charts and graphs and some of the things that would certainly be easy to do, but I wanted to find a way in which to talk about these truths through the eyes of individual men and women of African descent, often, but not necessarily, but certainly the men and women of that time who lived them, who lived on both sides of the issue of enslaving people, who lived on both sides of the issue of the American Revolution, both sides of the Civil War. I felt that the way you make history real and help people today realize the importance of understanding what has happened before them is by making it personal, by telling the stories of the individuals who lived during those times to the best of our capability. And fortunately, I was able to find, for example, the story of Anthony and Isabella, two of the 20-some-odd Africans who were on that first ship docked off Point Comfort in August of 1619. And what was so important for me, and I think also this is a really important aspect of the book, which differentiates it from just being about critical race theory, is this whole question of who were Anthony and Isabella and what kind of society did they step into? Now, some people will say that Anthony and Isabella were among the first enslaved individuals in the United States. I'm not one that agrees with that. And I don't agree with that for this reason. Anthony and Isabella stepped into a society where nothing had been determined yet. There wasn't that a group of white men in the Virginia colony had laid out a system of slavery back in England before they came to what would then become the United States, but was just America, was really just Virginia. They hadn't laid out a system that said, look, you know, if we ever get some folks of color here, when we get here and with the Native Americans as well, we're going to make them slaves. In other words, there wasn't a system of chattel slavery that existed in August of 1619. And the reason that that is so critically important is, as my dear friend and mentor, the late Lerone Bennett, often said, slavery was a road chosen. It did not have to be that way. And simply saying that slavery existed and these individuals were the first to be enslaved misses the point of how this country went from a country of indentured laborers to a country of plantation owners, indentured laborers, and the enslaved. And that's what I tried to do in the first couple of chapters of this book, is lay out the roads that could have been taken and the road that was, and how that road was taken, and the decisions that were made in taking that road towards chattel slavery. It happened over, I'm going to say it happened over about a 30 or 40 year period. From 1619, let's say 1620, to about 1660. And again, it was really important to me to understand that, because the very same issues that colonial Virginia society dealt with in the 1600s are still with us today. What do I mean by that? I mean this. The first was that the planter merchant class, the owners of the enslaved, wanted to make sure, since they were in the great minority, that they were also always going to be in majority control. And one of the things that comes clear to anyone reading the history of this period is the fear that this planter merchant plantation owning class had about those who were working for them, both Black and white, coming together, recognizing their power, and somehow usurping the power of, well, the colonial 1%. Let's call it what it is, because that's exactly what it was. You had the separation between the 1% and the 99%, and the 1% were really concerned about their power being usurped. And so they did everything that they could to make sure that white workers and Black workers didn't get together. The roads that could have been taken would have been roads toward equality in labor and opportunities. And that equality would have included the Native Americans who were here before these European colonizers got here. Would have included Africans who arrived after, like those Africans who came on the 1619 ship. That was the road not taken. The road that was taken was, as I said again, to separate out the workers to make sure they could be controlled. It is so clear. And the interesting thing is, this is the same strategy in play today. It's the same strategy which created the Southern strategy of the Republican Party, which eventually took over the role that the Democratic Party had in the South. It's the same strategy of those who remember Willie Horton. It's the same strategy we see today played out in school boards and school meetings, where white mothers and fathers are yelling and screaming that they don't want critical race theory taught in their schools. Of course, they don't even understand what they're saying they don't want taught. And what they're really saying, I think, beneath that is that they're scared that the truth of the history of this country might somehow be delivered to their children, who would not grow up in the same way as having the separation between Black folks and white folks that was put in place for one reason, really, and that was to be able to control labor in order to ensure the power and wealth of one class as opposed to the majority class, to ensure the power of the 1% as opposed to the power of the 99%. And that is still, as I said, an issue that's very much in play today. And so that's one of the main themes in the early part of the book that I try to pull through. I think another theme that was really important, became very clear, and that is a theory, really. It's not my theory. It's the theory of Edmund S. Morgan, is that in the United States, without bondage, there could never have been freedom. Wow. I mean, that's one that a lot of people just scratch their head and say, I don't get that. So let me just explain that in case you do have an opportunity to read the book. Let me say it again. Edmund S. Morgan, a famous professor at Yale University who studied slavery in this country, said, without bondage, there would be no freedom. And this is what he meant. In the lead up to the Revolutionary War, tobacco was the great crop in this country, which produced the greatest amount of wealth for the Jeffersons and the Washingtons and the Madisons and all of the founding fathers, so the founders. Tobacco was a very demanding mistress, and I talk about what it takes to raise just one tobacco plant. I mean, there's the planting and the reseeding and the cutting the top flowers so it doesn't flower and the drying of the leaves and the picking the bugs off. I mean, we're talking, this is a labor-intensive crop. And what Morgan was to say, and certainly I think my research in the book shows, is that if Jefferson and Washington and Madison had to actually farm their tobacco instead of enslaving people to do that farming, they would never have had time to pontificate on the great ideas of liberty and equality and fraternity for all. They would have been too busy figuring out, what do I need to do next? Am I planting, or am I plucking bugs, or am I drying the tobacco? That's what Morgan was saying, that it is in this very strange way that in this country, freedom is predicated on bondage. And I have to say, in the early stages of the pandemic, that's an idea that came through to me so clearly. You know, we talked about essential workers then. Of course, they don't have the same status they do now. And just think about it. There were so many of us who were privileged because there were people who were forced to risk their lives to provide the services which allowed for those privileged individuals to feel a certain degree of freedom from the direct effects of the pandemic. So that's a theory I also talk about in the, I would say, the middle stages of the book, how freedom is predicated on bondage in this country. And I certainly delve into a number of examples there. And I think one of the other things I at least wanted to share with you in the remaining few minutes that we have is another question that's very much with us today. Just 10 days ago, the California State Task Force on Reparations for Slavery actually issued one of its first decisions in which they said that if reparations were going to be issued, then they should be issued to people who could genealogically trace their ancestry back to Africa and to enslavement in this country. Of course, this was hotly debated among the committee, as it should have been. I think it's great to have that kind of discussion. One of the things that I talk about in the book towards the latter part is the efforts at reconciliation that were actually taken in this country right after the Civil War. Most Americans, Black or white, don't know that immediately after the Civil War, there were serious attempts to bring about reparations for the injury and harm done by, at that point, the 250-odd years that people of African descent had been held as slaves. And that's a really important moment, again, because it was a road that this nation started down and then did a very quick, abrupt face. And let me just sketch out the details for you. You can read a little bit more about it if you're interested in my book. Right after the Civil War, Abraham Lincoln had no plan for those who were enslaved that were no longer enslaved. I think that's really funny. I talk about in the book the fact that the South under Jefferson Davis actually had a plan. It was a plan in which the formerly enslaved would be relegated to basically serfdom. And I believe that's the word he actually used in this description of the South's plan. And again, I'm not going to go into it in real depth other than to say that what I tell people is that the North may have won the war, but the South got its way with the plan for what would happen with the formerly enslaved. Before that took place, though, Abraham Lincoln, through his general, William Sherman, developed a plan which many people know as 40 Acres and a Mule. It was technically termed Special Field Orders number 15, which actually allocated 400,000 acres of land, soon to be increased to almost a million acres of land, taken from former slave owners to be redistributed to the formerly enslaved. There was a bureau set up, the Freedmen's Bureau, to do this. General Oliver Otis Howard, who Howard University, a traditional HBCU, is named after, actually began the distribution of that land. Some 40,000 families by 1865 had applied for and been granted 40 acres in this huge tract of land, which was to be the reparations for the period of enslavement. Lincoln was assassinated. Johnson was the new president. And one of the first things he did was to cancel Special Field Orders 15 and return all of that land to the former slave owners. So I have said often that, first of all, I'm a big believer in reparations. I think the plan is already laid out. A lot of people will say, hey, wait a minute, but where do we even start in considering, contemplating the financial figure? And my response is this. The Congress knows, and we've got maps. I mean, I even have a map on my website of the acreage. So the acreage is very well known. It's very clear. The boundaries are specified really clearly. Had the Congress followed through, had the president followed through with that, those lands would have been redistributed to the formerly enslaved. Let's start with the value of that almost a million acres of land in today's money. And that's a great place to start with reparations because it's a follow through of what should have taken place and what could have taken place had an assassin not shot the president. So it is in this way that what I've tried to do with Of Blood and Sweat is to look at how events in the past are relevant to events taking place today. And the current public discourse on critical race theory or on reparations is simply a wonderful opportunity to do that and to take a serious look at what led to some of these important issues that we're talking about in the public sphere.